Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I hope that some more people will filter in. We were told that this was a hot ticket to get, but I guess with all sorts of other emergencies that have arise on the horizon in the last couple of weeks, and more about that in just a moment, we have some stiff competition tonight. We're going to be a hybrid solution this evening and have both a debate that we'll stage up here, and we hope to leave time for a town hall with some questions that really matter for a change. Right? Anyway, I'm Barry Bergdahl. I'm the Chief Curator of Architecture and Design here at the Museum of Modern Art and part of the curatorial team along with Peter Christensen, who has now flown the coop for Harvard but was for many years here, assistant curator and absolutely the backbone of this great adventure in realizing an exhibition that we think of as not only a manifesto about prefabrication and digital fabrication that we're here to talk about tonight, but we also hope was something of a manifesto of a way to go about doing an architectural exhibition as a research project about research projects. And so it's those research projects that we're going to talk about this evening, because the five architects who have worked so hard, or the five members of five architectural firms who have worked so hard with us, and I think also so selflessly to make it possible to do something unprecedented at MoMA, not to build one full-scale building, but five on this lot, which, if it proves to be recession-proof, will soon be a tower by Jean Nouvel for Gerald Hines. In any case, the museum is losing it as a provisional exhibition site for this great experiment at the end of the year when the five houses are disassembled and taken away. That we're not going to document in the website, but we're going to talk about it on the eve of their departure from the museum this evening. Let me just talk about, like they do on the presidential debates, a few minutes about how we're going to go about it and then introduce the subject and the speakers. This is, as you know, a project that began long before the exhibition opened. The lot, of course, you all know well. But I think it was an unusual exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in that it started almost 3.5 months before the opening party. With a website in which many of the people assembled in this room each week were required not only to figure out how they were going to get a building to MoMA, while, as was recorded on the right-hand side here of the screen, nothing was happening on the site. There was no evidence of any preparations at MoMA to receive these buildings that were being designed in five different offices at different points on either side of the Atlantic that were being assembled likewise in factories of production that had been brought into this experiment by the individual architects who wanted to work with fabricators on both tried and true and new ways of fabricating a building in advance of the preparation of its site. And then finally, all of this came together in July. But by that time, this website, Home Delivery, Fabricating the Modern Dwelling, had become a kind of stratigraphy of the geology of an experiment about prefabrication and digital fabrication with six dialoguers, five architects, and a curatorial team who also talked about the exhibition as a research project. Then the show opened. The houses were there. The process of the exhibition moved to the interior exhibition. And just a quick footnote, the exhibition closes inside next Monday. So if you haven't seen the contextualizing exhibition on the sixth floor yet, you have a few more days. The houses are remaining up for one further week. Their last day is a week from Monday, October 26th. And then the efficient, but for us painful process of disassembly will begin. What I wanted to do tonight was not so much document the disassembly, but actually ask together with the creators of these houses, since they've returned to MoMA for the first time as a group since the opening in July, a bit about how they see this in retrospect. Not only how their houses look to them once they put them together with those of four other colleagues who they only knew from names and from magazines as those who had been selected in MoMA's competition, but also as they see them in the project of home delivery, and then to look to the future and ask what are some of the things that we might learn for these individual research projects that they're going to talk to us about in sequence in a moment, and in the future for the future of prefabrication. There, of course, just to remind you of what we're talking about, which is part two of home delivery, which are the five houses, four of which you see here on the site. We will hear, I should switch ahead because this looking in the opposite direction, we'll hear this evening in order from James Timberlake of Kieran Timberlake of Philadelphia, the authors of the Cellophane House, the five-story house that arrived in 13 or 14 chunks. I can't remember. I think we'll hear about chunks from James in a moment, 14, no unlucky numbers involved, backgrounded against the CBS building. Next to it, in its numbered and not clad skin, Lauren Sass's digitally fabricated house for New Orleans. Larry is here this evening from MIT, and he'll speak. I'll introduce the speakers one by one as they come up. Then we will, moving to the center of the site, hear from Oscar Leo Kaufman, who together with his partner Albert Roof provided this beginning of a building system known as System 3, the beautiful light-colored building like a double-wide trailer that bisects the site there. And then Richard Horden, who may be the only who appears in both shots, both this one and the one before, the micro-compact house, the smallest but perhaps the most readily livable in its presentation of the houses, the micro-compact house. We'll talk about that house. And then finally, Douglas Gauthier and Jeremy Edmonston, who together are responsible for the Burst House, the authors of that second iteration of a house originally built in Australia on the 54th Street end of the site that glows there like a rising Australian sunrise to the north, will speak last. And then I'm going to moderate a discussion and ask them a couple of hard questions in the kind of PBS fashion. And it was an enormous pleasure to open once again another periodical. You can't go anywhere. Airline magazines, Amtrak magazine, travel magazines, the architectural press, the daily press. This exhibition has, in a most gratifying form, had an enormous resonance. Any given day on the sixth floor and out on the lot, everything from second grade classes to professional architectural students to the general public are crowding an architecture exhibition with patent drawings about the way that you assemble panels with joints. It's an extraordinary thing to behold. We have to thank not only everybody who participated, but Buster Keaton, who's a kind of crowd pleaser. But the discussion, I think, will go on long beyond tonight. So I think of this as yet another interim stage in this research project. This appeared in the Washington Post this weekend. And it accompanies an article on the home delivery show. So I'm not just fantasizing that this is a reverberation. I think you can read it for yourself. I guess home delivery has become yet another catchword in the topography and the cartography of prefabrication and what we might ask tonight, something of its relationship to the digital fabrication horizon. So what we have asked each team to do is to speak for about 5 to 10 minutes, just introducing us to the project and how it was an experiment for them, and then we'll gather together up here, have a discussion about what we've all learned, and open it to you for any questions. So the first speaker is James Timberlake of the Philadelphia firm of Kieran Timberlake. As I said, authors of the Cellophane House, but also authors of a book that even though it's a number of years old, I think four or five now, Refabricating Architecture, remains a manifesto for a different way of thinking about architecture when you are thinking about fabrication from the minute you put the pen to the paper or the finger to the CAD that's going to become the building, the BIM model in the end. They're both graduates of the University of Pennsylvania, where I believe they met, a school that was very famous in the 70s for very, very different things, and I think they've helped reposition some of the research there. They're both also graduates of the American Academy in Rome, but together in their practice now for quite a number of years, they have redefined a position about prefabrication, and I'm going to invite James to take the podium first to talk about that and how we saw it manifested here at MoMA. Thank you. And you'll get these if you just get two.
Okay. Thank you, and good evening, Barry. It's nice to be here and be with the fellow architects that helped produce the lot side of home delivery, and also to see Peter again. It's a nice reunion. I want to talk a little bit about where we began and some of the provocations in this house and do this quickly, and also touch a little bit on our lessons learned, because as a ISO-certified architecture firm, we have to learn from what we do. And so we constantly look at our research and go back into that and try to understand what it is that we did right and some of the things that we did wrong and how we might improve upon that. This was the first conception on the left and the and obviously the resultant on the right. And this was a clean sheet design, something that didn't exist before the invitation by MoMA to participate in the opportunity to be invited to, and be considered for the show. The house is considered was considered right from the get-go something that we were thinking of taking into production. And it's a mass customizable house in the sense that we designed it for an urban lot. We designed it to be potentially ganged in a multiplicity of arrangements. We designed it to be placed in a rural setting. And furthermore, we wanted that mass customizability to extend to the systems and the ideas within the house. Furthermore, this is going on in automatic, I think. Furthermore, the house was a provocation on going against the typical house, 90% on-site, 10% off-site. We wanted to reverse those figures. And we largely achieved that. Our first act of design was to design the process and how all of this was to come together. It wasn't about the sketch on paper, but how was it that we were going to bring the assembler and the fabricator and the architect together, and who were the suppliers that were going to participate in that? And that was part of our proposal to MoMA, the kind of realization of this. As you could see in that initial sketch, it all organized itself around the idea of a frame that would then have off-the-shelf components brought to it and mass customizable options. It was a provocation that it wasn't about making construction so much as it was about bringing assembly to a site. And so that led us to a very, very different set of diagrams and choices about materials and about arrangements of those materials. It was designed for assembly, and as you'll see when it's taken down, it's also designed to be disassembled as well in that kind of order there. It's a series of 14 chunks, a series of tabletops or table legs and tops with bridge pieces in between. And it was designed with this sort of strict schedule in mind and then an idea about where it might go as part of our provocation to MoMA. This is the realization. The original schedule on the left, the actual schedule on the right. As you can see, if you just make some of the translations across in that schedule, the schedule became incredibly more complex, and we had a few schedule busts along the way. It was designed to be 100% recyclable. We think we've achieved 90%. This diagram says 82. I'd like to differ with our diagram, but we're closer to 90%. And it's made out of aluminum, out of glass, out of plastic, and all of those are restreamable and recyclable. Part of the assembly strategy was considering those recyclable and reusable pieces, those discrete parts that are able to come together in an assemblage through the aegis of basically a wrench or snapping those pieces together, and then we can disassemble it exactly the same way. So this was the assembly diagram and the assembly strategy and the first chunk coming in. This was a little kind of movie strip of our take on how that might come together. And then this is the actual time lapse of that assembly coming in. And so you see the stair chunks at the rear on the south, and they're pre-wrapped coming in, and the front chunk. And then you'll see a bridge piece that comes in, and the bridge piece in this particular case will have one of the bathroom, a pre-assembled bathroom chunks on it. And that repeats itself up through the context of the house through the end. You can see the sort of ballet of lifts that are going on here, and the men and work people crawling all over this. The chunks are shrink-wrapped. They're then canvassed to protect from rain, and then those canvases are taken off, and you'll see ultimately the shrink wrap come down. The last stair chunk and the last bathroom chunk. And it's this provocation of not building in a single story or a double story that we had realized already really existed. And I think this is part of the debate we'll probably have tonight, part of the conversation. I think our provocation was we really wanted to know whether or not we could build over two stories and how we could do it in the amount of time that this took. We originally planned this to be 5 days. It took six to get 70% of the house on site. It took another 10 days to 13 days to get the last 30% done. And part of that was a bust in the pre-assembly stream in terms of some of the supply chain not feeding the assembler in the exact order that we wanted to go. So the BIM model was to be the document that controlled all of this. Unfortunately, I think some people along the line, and this is part of our lessons learned, didn't trust the BIM all the way to know that it was going to fit, and that led to a higher degree of on-site assembly than we had hoped. It looks simple, but it's actually rather complex, and that joint on the right shows you the number of bits that are coming together. And the elegance with which that does come together, but that complexity adds to the amount of time on site. This view of Coleman's plant in northern Lebanon, New Jersey, just shows you the sort of sequence of frame and other bits along the way, the connectors of lighting, the three-form floors along the way that are laid out on that floor, and part of that fabrication process and part of the pre-assembly that goes on before it's shrink-wrapped and then put on a truck and brought to the site, lifted by crane, bit by bit. For the most part, these assemblies, you know, came in and fit on top of one another, with the exception of the second floor chunk at the front, which was slightly out of alignment because one of our diagonals was too strongly stressed. And that held us up over a half a day. It made everybody here sweat, holding us up for a half a day while we unstressed that particular joint, and then the chunk slipped down into place. There are a number of off-the-shelf components, but a number of custom and patentable components that we had to design in order to bring them together because of the amount of shear and moment resistance that was required for this very, very light frame. The bathroom was off-site produced in the UK, flat-packed, and then brought to Coleman and then pre-assembled. And I think one of the great lessons learned is that some of these pre-assembly pieces, the more of that we can do, the higher the quality and the lower the amount of time we would have on site. Unlike some of the blogs and some of the critique, we actually did design this house for systems. We didn't put these particular systems in place. It is intended to be naturally ventilated, which is what it was, but it does have the photovoltaic transfers and the potentiality for the radiant heat system, which was designed to go in place. The LED lighting is a very high-efficiency, low-energy lighting system, but intended to be supplemented by things that would be furnished within the house. And so this is just a quick tour through the polycarbonate stair, the three-form flooring that adds to the translucency of the house, and the provocation that you can live transparently or translucently in this modern age. A view out through the smart wrap walls, the PET walls that are recyclable and embedded with a lot of technology, and then a couple of views at the show and at the opening. We particularly love this image because it's the little house, just like the book. I think somebody else is next, Barry.
That was marvelous, just in broad delivery. Thank you. The second speaker and the temporary next-door neighbor of James Timberlake is Lawrence Sass, whose whole project is very near and dear to my heart for a number of reasons. It was partly because Larry Sass not only moves between at MIT, between really computer science and architecture, but he also moves between architectural history and architectural production in his use of the computer. He's worked on analyzing Palladio through computer models, and he's also worked on how one might fabricate new buildings and through computer models. And those two researches come together in the House for New Orleans, which is both a computer analysis of the typology of the shotgun house of New Orleans, which we associate particularly with part of the hardest-hit territory of that city, that suffering city, the Ninth Ward, and a analysis of how the similar computer thinking might design a house to replace that fabric in a way that can deliver something that is both expected and unexpected, and which, and this is the reason that I was so attracted to it, although it appears as a proposition for New Orleans, as a possibility, and has in it latent possibilities, I think, for worldwide application about technology transfer from places of high learning to places perhaps of low skill and great need. And I think that's a great potential of the House for New Orleans. So I suppose as much an introduction, Larry, to your great project as to yourself. But would you take the stage and tell us something about the House for New Orleans?
Yeah, I realize there's no way I could really talk about this from an architect's point of view, so a lot of this stuff, material is going to be a little bit on the academic side. And you'll have to forgive me if it seems a little technical, but the technical parts were the most challenging. The stuff we did at MIT before we arrived here in New York were just by far the hardest parts of the work, but I think still the most interesting. I could always talk about this from the New Orleans point, but I think that most of you get that. I think that the real learning and the stuff that we're going to take forward is going to be the computational part. So I kind of talked about this and talked about it a lot in the blog from three points: the computer, the machinery, and what's the last one? And the assembly on site, trying to as desperately as possible not to cut anything while we were on site. And the only tool that we used while we were here, well, we cheated a couple of times and used a saw to cut a couple of bad parts, but the main tool that we used was this little handheld router on site. We very seldomly used any other tool, and we couldn't use another tool, and part of it is because we cut all the parts in Virginia, and if a part wasn't cut right, we couldn't go back to Virginia to recut one part, so every part had to be perfect before it arrived. Most of you know that the whole thing is made out of plywood. It's plywood and plastic, all held together by glue and friction. We tried desperately not to use any, well, we didn't use any bolts other than on the floor. But the real core principles behind this is that we can make any shape. We can make a New Orleans house. We can make a yurt, a round shape. We can make any shape. And the advantages of this are that we don't need a factory. We could do this stuff on site. We originally wanted to do like we did here in the image, to cut on site, locate the machine next to the house, and cut all the parts and put them together all in 2 or 3 weeks. Unfortunately, New York City won't allow us to do that. And we had hoped to control waste that way. We could take all the skeletons, send them back to where we got them, and they could be recycled. But we hope over time to be able to do this not just for New Orleans, but for other types of houses, as I was explaining. So here's sort of the process. It starts as a very simple computer model. It can be any shape, rough shape. We take that computer model and subdivide it into small parts and run that over a laser cutter. And the key is making the prototype. So you can see two different prototypes. One is at one thickness of material, and the second one is a little bit thicker material. And then if those two work, if all the parts are correct, we just enlarge the file 6 times and send it to another machine and cut all the parts. And actually, this one at the bottom, of course, Nick Rader is here today. He's in the photograph. He's one of my students that cut this one. And the machine is right on the other side of the wall in back of the house. So it was a very simple process. And just like I showed you in that last image, you could locate the machine right next to the building. So this is where I really got most of my inspiration, the technical parts of my inspiration. And it's all about, the building is all about trying to work the same way that a three-dimensional printer works. Three-dimensional printers are popular in architectural firms today, in large firms. You take a computer model, send it to a machine, and the machine produces a model like the one at the bottom, lower right-hand side. Three-dimensional printer, invented at MIT back in the 80s, was the software for it is the core component. And what it does is it takes a slice through a three-dimensional model. A person, like a student here, makes a CAD model. The software for the machine takes a very thin slice through the machine and sends that section one layer at a time to the three-dimensional printer, like it is in the upper, see if I can get this laser pointer to work, like over here. And this little head, which is a simple printer head, draws each section one at a time. Eventually, you end up with all of these sections glued together. The machine does 3 operations. It measures, manufactures the layer, and assembles it to a previous layer. So this one machine does 3 operations at once, and once you brush away the loose powder, you end up with this solid object. But you could see here the printer in action, the printer head and the section, and the section is glued to the previous section. And this principle we tried desperately to do with the project. So here's the process. There were 5 simple steps. The first step was to design the project, and we follow through on a cabin project. This is the cabin. And the idea with New Orleans, if anybody's ever visited New Orleans and seen a shotgun house, you'll see that the backside is always the same. It's the front that's different and unique. And if you have about 109,000 houses and all of them have to be unique, you need an automated process. So here we use 3-dimensional printing to test the front. And so this was part of the original proposal. And in the end, we end up with this, when you join them together, a cabin in the back and this unique front. And the idea is that anyone can make any one of these facades by going online and setting up a CAD file or very simple web tool and designing their own components and assembling them into a model. We would take this model, this one here, and we would run it through the next step. And this is where the real complications came in and real complexity was in taking that rough shape, like up here, and subdividing that step by step into many smaller components so that in the end you end up with this one, a library of parts. We built a brand new library. We challenged and tested the library by building these large mock-ups. If a part didn't work, we tested it and we redesigned it. But the core innovation for us was the relationship between this model and this model, the one that's inside of the building. And what that meant was that any shape that we made here, we knew that we could fabricate here, and we knew that there was a direct relationship between the two. If it fit here, it was going to fit here. So that meant that we could work on this model all the way up until the last day of cutting. The third step was manufacturing, and the previous step, I should tell you, was where the most fights broke out. We always had disputes between how to model something, principles of grids and modularity and things like that, things that I would never really get into in detail, but and silly things over labeling, yes, labeling of files, just things that you don't think are that important, but when you're working with thousands of little parts and objects, they become really critical. So here's where another piece of innovation came in. We worked with the people at ShopBot, and they had a person that was doing a little bit of programming with them, and we came up with this idea of micro components or micro cuts. And those are the little tiny things that help us to assemble parts a lot easier. So in here you see these four little cylindrical shapes at the corners. That allows us to put parts together a lot easier, a lot simpler. And then we have other little things like rounded edges and stuff like that, things that would make things a lot easier on site, faster, cheaper, and quicker to put together. But again, these innovations came from working with somebody that had already been working with computers for a while. So then on-site, that's when sort of our spoiled marriage started to come back together and we started loving each other again. And here, see, it was the one tool that we used, and that was to release the parts from the skeletons. They arrived in one truck. We had a couple of smaller trucks over time, but the main body of the project arrived in one truck, on one truck. And all of the parts, and this was one of the little micro things that we learned how to do, was write a little script so that these parts came with this little tiny tab, and we could release the parts with this, cut the tabs with this little tool. And again, all of the parts pretty much fit together. Out of the 5,000 major parts, we had, I think it was 4 or 5 that were wrong, and that we recut at MIT and brought down here on a truck. So you have the main body, which is the gray material, and that's all of that information is taken from the cabin project. There's really, for us, there really wasn't a lot that was new. The new stuff was the ornamentation. And the technical part of this is, if you think about three-dimensional printing is layers in one direction. And what we tried to do was not just print in one direction, we tried to layer stuff in three directions, in an X, Y, and Z axis. So this ornamentation is the X axis. And what that means is, in the future, the next project, we could make snap-on finishes. So right now, the project is really just a structure. And the goal is to next have snap-on finishes. And what that means is that every single project could be made off-site and manufactured by a CNC machine or computer numerically controlled machine. And so this is my last slide. I want to sort of leave you with sort of the main point of this for me, which is trying to return back to this image here. And this was some of the stuff that Barry talked about. When I first started teaching in the 90s, I taught a class on Palladio, and the class was all about using high technology to three-dimensional printing to study some of Palladio's work. But the one thing that we discovered about Palladio was how great he was as a builder. He really knew a lot about building and construction. In fact, in this slide, one of these dentils, when we were, this is a Redentore, I think it is, we were up on a scaffold, and one of these dentils had just fallen off by just touching it. And it was because the dental was made by another architect after Palladio had died. Palladio always knew to turn stone a certain direction so that over time it would not drip. And Bertolotti Scamozzi didn't know that, so he put the stone in a different direction, and over time it slowly started to bend. And when we were up there, you could just take your hand and pop it off. Mind you, we were 200 feet up in the air. But one of the things that we learned from doing this is the relationship between drawings and making and drawings and making, and that was the whole point of this project for us. It was bringing back the idea of design and making as part of the design process, not just looking at the visual components, but also looking at how things are made. So I really want to thank Barry and Peter for the opportunity to do this. This was by far one of the greatest things that I've ever had the chance to do, and I hope to do it again soon.
Our third speaker takes us to the middle of the site and also to the middle of Europe. Oscar Leo Kaufmann, together with his partner Albert Ruf, have already achieved a certain amount of fame in this country. They have been working on the prefabrication of buildings in Dornbirn in Austria, in the famous Vorarlberg region. It's largely associated with famous craftsmanship, but they have taken this actually to off-site fabrication and delivery. They're known in this country in the pages of Dwell magazine, in Alison Arif's book on prefab, in which an earlier project appears on the cover. But for MoMA, they decided to push this research further, and this was what was appealing to us. System 3 was part of an ongoing research project in which prefabrication didn't become the satisfaction of achieving a model and replicating it over and over, but remains a continued exploration of form and delivery, and most particularly, and I'm sure that Oscar will talk a bit about this to us, but for me, his house represents one solution to the perennial and also perennially boring debate between flat packers and modular people. And System 3, I think, puts that to rest and says kind of both and. in its approach to the topic. So, Oscar, thank you for coming back to talk to us about System 3.
Good evening. I just want to give you, in the beginning, a short overview of the System 3. I just wanted to explain the main idea, and then I would like to give you a short explanation about the process of the material, and then in the end I would like to talk about the assembly here in New York. As we do in this now for, I would say, at least 12 years, we did different prefab systems, boxes, units, and whatever. So we were really surprised when Peter called last year and he invited us for a competition to enter a competition for the home delivery. So when we heard that, we said, okay, we should try to develop a new system, take all our experience and do something fresher, smarter. So we tried to get rid of all the mistakes we came up to that day. And three mistakes we always had in that was, one mistake was the transportation. The second mistake we think was the the production, that we didn't, that we couldn't produce, industrialize, and the time, the construction, the building time itself. So when we came to that point, first of all, and I think the biggest thing which will go through the whole project as a red line, we divided the building into two parts. We said, we have serving units and naked space, we call it. Serving unit is meant, serving unit, the red one, is meant that everything we need for like installations, electricity, staircases, kitchens, and stuff like that is brought as one piece. And the naked space is just wooden panels which are just connected to the serving unit, and they are not installed, so they don't have anything to do with the unit. So they are just space or room creating panels. So for the transportation, let's say one of these serving units will probably serve three grids of naked elements. We think we could at least bring the transport down by 80%. So that was our first thing with the idea to do this. Then here you can see that again. We have this is an open section where you can see the serving unit, and the wooden plates are just plugged to the serving unit, and it's just space. It's just living space, but they are not installed, and all the services are coming out of the box. Then, next thing we were looking for was a material, and also a production method, how we could be quite fast and cost reducing. So we found this wooden plates, industrial material, and combined with the CNC technology, for us it was the perfect combination, because you just put the wooden boards on the machine, then the machine cuts out the windows, all the holes, and you, in the end, you have ready-made wall, floor, and ceiling elements. The second thing which is really good at this, wood is a sustainable material, and on the other side, it's quite well insulating. Here you can see the four steps. So the first step is that we put it on the CNC, then CNC finished, then we coat the thing, and then in the end the windows got in. And then these naked elements go in storage. So We have two things. We have the serving units produced and a high quality production, and then we have these elements that just running through through a street, through machine street. These are just a couple of examples how it could work. I mean, as I said in the beginning, this is actually meant to be a bigger system. It's not only for single houses. It was meant more for big structures. So smallest unit over there, the first one is just one serving unit with one grid of naked elements. And then you can see what you wanted to show. Actually, this was the MoMA proposal, but we couldn't bring it because it was too expensive. Then this is just fiction. We just wanted to show what could be possible with this system going up, let's say 8 or 9 stories high. This is we call it an office tower. And then the same thing, we try to find fields in which we could sell these units. So hotels, hostels, or whatever, offices. so we saw it in a little bit. Bigger scale, the whole thing. And now the production. So in this picture, you can see the CNC, how it cuts out the little holes. This is a picture I really like because actually all of the boards come from this KLH, the producer, and they really did everything very exact. So nobody at the production company here in this room. They didn't have to screw to make holes to do something with it. We just put all the panels on the floor, and then they coated it with this Covelan. This is a boat coating. We found that out. I don't know. I think my partner found the coating out. They give us 30 years guarantee on that coating. And so our idea was to have really a serving unit and then put all the elements together, and then with the screws, you will see it later on, just to hold it together. And with the screws, this system should be expandable, movable. You can take one wall away, put another grid of naked elements in. So we also wanted to create a system which lives with the people. So if you're a young guy, you buy a small piece, and if you get family, you can prolong it, make it bigger, move to another place. Then here you see how we put the windows in. Everything is CNC cut, and you see the single pieces over there. Then this is the serving unit with the two insulation shafts. In the middle is the storage. Behind that is the staircase. Kitchen and bathroom. This is also the serving unit. We covered it with a steel frame because this is the one piece which is delivered in one whole piece. So if you go take it with a crane and it hits something, then not the whole thing is gets. Now this transport from Austria. We put it in the. Then we arrived in New York. Here you can see how we put the serving unit out of the container. Then we have these 20 foundations, adjustable foundations. So first of all, we had to bring them on the same height, and then we just put the service unit on them. And then here you can see that all the rest, all the elements, they just were brought one by one, and then to close the house. And what you can see on the elements, there is no installation, and there won't be an installation afterwards. So the only installations are in the service unit. So that serves the whole house. Yeah, this is my companion, Albert. Here you can see. So this was a special made connection because we didn't want to have. We didn't want to have the connections on the roof because of the water. So we have this connection is just outside, and then from the inside you screw it. Then these are just a couple of exhibition pictures. I think you already know them. I would like to thank you, Peter, and Barry and Peter. That's about it.
We wanted desperately to sleep in this house, but actually the city regulations, it's an exhibition, they're actually not five houses, so we were never able to have more than dinner in that house, but that was also a wonderful experience. But it is, like the next house we're going to talk about, one that really does feel like it's ready to be moved into. We want to go to the very center of the site, to the smallest house, and to the only one that is actually always already in production before the exhibition opened, and this is, of course, the Micro Compact Home. And it's designed by Horton Cherry Lee Architects together with Hack and Hüpfner of Munich. The principal author here is Richard Horton, and he's here with us tonight. He was the founding partner of the London-based firm Horton Cherry Lee Architects. He trained at the AA in the 1960s and was one of a handful of people there who became fascinated, interestingly enough, with other figures in this exhibition, notably the Eames, as well as the whole case study program rediscovered by a couple of not only retrospective but foresightful English architects in those years. Since the 1970s, his firm has been committed to achieving more with less, optimizing visual and technical lightness with a minimal use of materials. And this is, in fact, the subject matter of his research laboratory at the Technical University in Munich, where he has been a professor for a number of years, working with students on lightweight structures and a whole series of experiments, of which the Micro Compact House is only one. And without telling anything more about this career. I think that Richard has been at it the longest of the group we've brought together tonight and in the exhibition. I would just give a plug for his beautifully produced new book that takes on something of the shape of the house, and that is Micro Architecture, that was published a little bit earlier this year and explains the full range of his practice, of which he's only going to give us one cubic fragment this evening. So thank you for coming back, Richard, to MoMA.
Thank you very much, Barry and Peter Christensen. For what I enjoy about this project is the exhibition, is the different perspectives that we each have on prefabrication. So it's, if you like, totally different. Prefabrication doesn't mean one thing. It means a wide range of things. This is like an aperitif, I think, our little and our little tiny project is very, very small, but it's actually put together by a massive team of students and assistants at the Technical University in Munich. We had 260 students and at one point producing models and so on. So what you're looking at is the product of an intense work, but it's also the perspective on prefabrication comes from European manufacturing culture. And I want to say something about the way I see that. And this, for example, is uniquely European. It's handling the large scale and the small scale with great beauty and a care for the tiny cup of coffee. And this is an important thing, I think, to make, that quality in Europe doesn't matter. Scale does not matter. It's the quality that counts. And for me, this is an evocative image in terms of the driving image of the microhome. So the European culture as we know it, manufacturing culture, is the Aston Martin, the Ferrari, the Lamborghini, and so on. So I wanted to make a building that took on this scale, if you like, this product design scale that we know is produced in a factory efficiently and fast. Other images, you know, from the 350 horsepower Porsche on the left to the 45 horsepower Smart has the same loving care in its design and integrity. So what I wanted to communicate is that a tiny house can be a beautiful house, a beautiful home. And this is only experienced by using it, I'm afraid. It's not possible to see it. European manufacturing culture ranges from the micro compact home is made near Munich, actually in Austria, near the just to the right of the BMW symbol you can see in Munich. But of course, in Italy, it's the Ferrari, Lamborghini in the manufacturing, and a quarter of the world's car production is produced in that area of Germany, you see that. So manufacturing is not only a love of Europe, design love, it's also in a wonderful environment. We teach in this beautiful place, close to the mountains, with BMW headquarters right at in the foreground here, with a wonderful standard of manufacturing culture immediately available to the students. It has well-known buildings, Munich, BMW, new building by, and it has a fantastic environment. So it's a hop, a 40-minute hop on a light plane to Venice and to Italy. So the cultural exchange that's going on is an incredibly rich field to work in Europe. The first project we did, actually, having said all that, is started in Philadelphia when I was teaching in Pennsylvania and with two students or team of students in Philadelphia. And here is the ski house, the first one, a little light 350-kilogram house, 0.3 of a ton, which can be lifted with a helicopter over the Alps and placed on this ridge near the Matterhorn. So this is attention to weight, attention to performance, fast installation, fast removal. Another example of a recent student project inspired by Swiss graphics, by Swiss graphic design. So the design is coming from a different polar projects, and even work with NASA on the International Space Station, where our team now have a seat restraint unit on the International Space Station. So we're ranging in a wide way. An event center for Mountain. I put the website, I hope you can, if you want to make notes, take the websites. Norman Foster is attending one of the presentations of my students in St. Moritz. Microcompact home, touching the earth lightly, trying to do that energy-wise, in an energy sense, as well as that it uses the minimum energy to manufacture it because it's small, lightweight, and 2.2 tons, about the same as a Range Rover or a Bentley. Timber frame, not looks aluminium, but it's a timber frame inside. Coming from aviation, of course, we know from aviation that we have a very high standard. We can have a very high standard. Sadly, often we don't. But from a tiny space, we can have a very high quality experience in design. So we take the cue from aviation. Primarily, the micro-compact home comes from aviation. Here's the crew cabin on an Airbus A340, which is where the crew sleep during a long-haul flight, for example, from Munich to Los Angeles. Here's the team with wooden prototype before manufacturer. Here's the manufacturer at the top of my concept sketches, which I gave to the students before we started. The 2.6 meter cube, that's about 9 foot cube. And in that, we have two double beds, kitchen, bathroom, shower, toilet, air conditioning, heating, Nespresso machine, two televisions, etc., etc. And here's the village where the students live, and I live in Munich when I'm there, two nights a week. So it's short-stay smart living. Delivery in 5 minutes when you've prepared the frame on the ground. I park my smart car under the house, and you can see the quality of Swiss fittings we use, and the LED lighting uses only 80 watts for the whole house, 80 watts for the whole house. We use 10 kilowatts for the whole day. And that's including the Nespresso machine and the kettle and the hot water heating. You see what I mean about aviation quality finishes, fitting the laptop, the iPod, and so on. So it's a young person's home. This it's not. Probably most of us in this room wouldn't touch it, but for young people, it's a delight, and it's lovely to see them using it, and for them to move in November 2005 and still be there now in November 2008 coming up. And sponsors, O2 Germany to begin with, secondly, UBS Switzerland. Wonderful to have the opportunity of sponsorship from MoMA, and Vitro Design Museum are now calling us, knocking on our door for the next project. Snowboard villages become a possibility where you park, we even have a snow rack. We can deliver by helicopter. This is the one that delivers the ski house to 4,000 meters. We can have sailing events, rapid installation. We can have tree villages made vertical to make... We can put something in Venice, a romantic point in Venice. We can make carbon-neutral houses, and we can make family compact homes. My own home consists of 44 in England on the south coast, 44 micro-compact homes, and 40 times the energy use and 40 times the light energy use. So that gives you an idea, and it's about 2,800 square feet. Is that right? Yeah. Square feet, yes, 280 square meters. So, but a smart car as well in my home in England. So, thank you to MoMA tremendously for the opportunity and to be able to thank you from the students, because an incredible thing to come to MoMA with a student project. Most grateful to you for that chance. The little book, do have a look. It tells you something about, records the blogs, and it tells you something about the origin of the project. Thank you very much indeed.
Of course, everyone is in love with the house, Richard, but I'm hoping you'll tell us why it needs two television sets. But the last team is Jeremy Edmondson and Doug Gauthier. They brought to us Burst 008. Despite its name, it is actually the second iteration of a large-scale experiment in digital fabrication that they first undertook in Jeremy Edmondson's native Australia and then recreated for us here with variation. I hope they'll talk about that a little bit. They have both, I believe, trafficked through Colombia, which has become one of the American sites of fascination with digital fabrication. And we're particularly eager for them to be part of this experiment in which the relationship between digital fabrication and prefabrication were, in a sense, going to be force-fit together. This is a kind of engineered marriage of the exhibition that I'm surprised has called for very little commentary. But during the construction here on the home delivery site, both the potential and the extraordinary design innovations, formal innovations of digital fabrication, as well as the what is temporarily its downside of a complete renaissance of craft and hand labor that's usually not part of the discourse, were evident, and I think they're going to take on some of that in talking not only about the design brilliance of Burst 008. They wanted to call it Burst 007, I'll admit, but I didn't allow that. I thought it was somehow too suspect. But it also, I think, laid bare in a very, very brave way some of the things that are they're struggling with, and like so many others, in trying to take the potential of the computer into the fabrication of non-standard objects. So Jeremy and Doug, would you take us back outside and see what you've bursted for us?
The Burst project is a complex and baroque project that, to explain fully, will probably take more time and attention span than we have here. Or as we've said, perhaps a bit too often, the Burst house is much more fab than pre. So what we're hoping to do is explain the concepts and reasons that we're interested in this type of architectural and research project. The slides will automatically flow for the 10 minutes we're talking and not necessarily align with the words.
Perhaps our project pushes the conventional idea of prefab, but Douglas and I have always imagined that Burst is an unlikely marriage between balloon frame and the kit of parts. The balloon frame that is so beautifully replicated on the sixth floor of the show, and the kits of Prouvé, Fuller, and many others. The kit, as the pre-show, the 6 weeks on site, demonstrated, has a life of its own. It responds to the limits of the site and the method of delivery. For the show, many of our parts were pre-assembled and delivered as chunks, where they were unfolded or burst into place. They allowed the construction process to be choreographed, presenting a theatrical work in itself, or, as one pundit said, every stage of the construction is beautiful. The workers must be so happy. I remember it a little differently, but there you have it. The balloon frame historically offered greater precision in producing accurately room sizes and heights, and Burst takes this a step further by allowing a precision that is tied to a completely other range of values. For an example of this measuring or this other set of values, we can go to our engineers, Bjor Happelt, who once measured climate by the seasons and predominant currents, but now they measure microclimates. They understand the nuances and subtleties of weather, not only at the scale of the site, but within the spaces or the cubic inches of a room. Also, the structural forces of the dwelling that are not only tested against the dead weight or the of the building or the prevailing wind, but now they're tested against the action of floods, hurricanes, and earthquakes. Further, sustainability measures the heat gain and energy consumption throughout the year and also across the living room. So the ambition for Burst is that this laser-cut plywood and steel balloon frame can respond to these other units of measure, these micro units of measure, that the system offers not just a single suggested answer to the synthesis of this criteria, but then in each iteration and deployment of the system, a range of values is manifested throughout the space. It's a high-performing unit, digitally measured and understood before it is procured. Put another way, the indoor space becomes a celebration of the outdoor experience, an experience that is nuanced and varied.
In some ways, that negotiation of program, structure, and environmental issues allows us to take responsibility again, to take on more of the issues, more of the concerns, and so that we push the prefab into another realm where we set up different conditions for architecture. In our research on fabrication and the understanding gained from the 84 projects in the overall show, we understand that prefab is not necessarily a successful model. It's, in many ways, a utopian project that many architects and thinkers have grappled with. And what we found is a lot of times it was perhaps a respite from smaller residential work being heavily client-driven, and the potential for an architect to actually design not for a single person but for the every person. And in some ways, it's more closely associated with the core concepts of architecture and becomes almost a manifesto. That's in looking at all the other people that have grappled with this. We pulled that down. And so the overall home delivery show makes us question the Burst project's position and takes the question in some ways to a favorite utopian project, which is Constant's New Babylon. In this nano future, I'm oversimplifying Constant, is that machines take care of everything, life is easy, so everyone's a designer. So we spend the rest of our lives designing houses, designing cities, and moving on, and designing and redesigning them again. And in that space, what is the architecture? What distinguishes architecture? What is the question of architecture when anything and everything is possible? And what we find is that the project is called formally innovative, and that in some ways that's a way of also dismissing the project, of saying, well, it's the hubris of the architect to build the shapes and language they want. Well, we would say that that's not the case with the form, that the taking the responsibility and attitude of building and making and creating that form, it provides a frame for the negotiation of environment, social, political, and any other issues that architecture should and wants to take on. So in that case, the project is the frame that is then this responsibility or language that we consider the concepts of architecture. Well, in some ways, that was us explaining the project, and we wanted to show it to you as we were taking it through. I think in some ways, the digital is allowing us to take on more responsibility. Going back to another condition of where this project in various exposure of the pressure and difficulties of putting it together, the craftsmanship, as you call it, we do return to another architecture, to a historical position where we actually, the innovation of figuring stuff out isn't just on your desk or in your discussion or in your phone book. It's actually out there on the field of play in the space that other people occupy. And I think the Burst House, the look of it, the language of it, the graphics of it, are all quite light and humorous, but it's a project that we want to present as 100% serious.
There's a couple more slides, and we need to thank you and Peter for the incredible opportunity. The first time we did this, the house became very private. It was for a private client. It was also in a place that was very inaccessible for anyone to see and go through. And the show just gave us a... We always felt that project was very interesting, and the show gave us a place to make the project more public. It's been fantastic to see so many responses to it and get that feedback. So really, we really want to thank you for that.
And the expression of the thanks is... Barry criticized the burst flower from the very beginning. I think Peter might have been behind that as well. And we listened. We listened carefully. And we took into consideration every critique of the Venturi-like language of the flowers. And we decided in the end to turn the flowers up to 13 and to turn them into skylights and windows. And those are the last slides you'll see tonight. Thank you.
I'd like to ask all six architects to join Peter Christensen and myself up on the stage, and we have a couple of questions to ask jointly, and then to open it up to the audience for a few questions. I know some of you are very eager that we stay on time because you want to hear another debate, but this one I'm sure will be riveting and will also have long-term consequences. I hope you've heard already in the five presentations, and I want to thank all of you for your subscription to just-in-time delivery, part of my ambitions for the lot have been recapitulated this evening. I wanted very much, I think, this historic occasion to actually create a village instead of a single object, as was the case of the House in the Garden series 60 years ago, that people would come upon a lot of prefabricated houses, factory-made houses, and the first thing that they would see was Noah's Ark. Here are five radically different species. Nobody, no matter how naive, can actually leave that site and still hold on to the notion that the idea of a prefabricated house, the house that Douglas just referred to as the house for everyone instead of the house for some particular one, is going to lead to a standardized world of identical cookie-cutter images, and that architectural creativity is going to be annihilated by this procedure. I think that, if anything, the home delivery, in its deliberate embrace of a variety of positions, has also made an argument for creativity and for mass customization in a way. I'd like to sort of move from the microcosm of the show out to the macrocosm, I suppose, of the future in a couple of questions that I'm going to allow you freely to jump in the order that you like to respond. Part of it is just to ask you, and I suppose it's a very selfish question from Peter Christensen, who's been mentioned as now the new addition on stage. Peter and my, apart for having curated this show, and I'm very grateful for all the allusions to it, but as a historian and a curator, as historians and curators, how you thought about your project differently once it was delivered to MoMA and put in a context that was our context, the context of this history and thematic setting for prefabrication, as well as, of course, your neighbors, which might not have been of your own choosing, which were of our choosing. So even whether it's how you might have seen your own work, this individual work, or your larger research project that you've detailed for us, perhaps differently in relationship to the larger exhibition project, if at all. Does anybody want to...
Any takers?
...to tackle that? Any takers?
I guess I'll say something first. You know, in the context of it, I think that began before it even got to the lot. You know, obviously doing something that MoMA asks you to participate in changes, I think, some of the considerations. I think probably the broadest manifestation of that in our house, having been a clean sheet piece, was really the acrylic stair. That isn't something that probably makes it to production. But in the context of exploring the translucency and the transparency of it, I think, you know, we had to take it to that nth degree in the stair. In the context of then seeing our house in the context of the other houses, I think this is where some of the critics and certainly the blogs have gotten it wrong. I think this isn't about a beauty contest at all, but it is about, and I think some of the critics have really missed the point about the exploration of this as the process and the opportunities that these five houses all represent, unlike classicism, there's no one language that's going to get us to the answer here. And all of these represent viable opportunities to build in specific locations and in specific situations economically and, you know, with high quality and less amount of time. And so in the end, I think that's that was the, sort of the beauty of arriving there thinking you have the answer, but then, you know, looking around and understanding that the answer is much broader than your own.
Once the project was delivered, finally, in our case, take a sort of position with the group of five, the sort of five arguments that are on the lot. And each of them is very different, but as we were asked to explain the project to many different sort of groups, it became clear that on any different day, you know, our project had a close affiliation with, you know, one other project, and that other project was often different depending on the day. You know, under one explanation, our project seemed very close to Larry's, you know, in terms of the CNC milling and the plywood. On another day, it had a lot to do with the, you know, touching the earth lightly, you know, idea, the sort of zero impact
a heating and cooling system, the sort of legs that touch down. It seemed like that was an interesting part of the project or the process for us, is to step back and see the five arguments that you're part of and how, you know, we related to that and how that relationship would change.
I'm happy that you say that, because I think every time I've given a tour of the exhibition and the outside part in particular, as an art historian, someone who's trained to make categories and typologies, exactly the same thing happened. Sort of a new set of categories would operate for that day. And even in the site planning, we deliberately made them in, you know, recombinatory families over and over again.
Yeah, Peter. Certainly, we're only touching upon half of the exhibition here. And one thing that I'm very interested in raising with all of you quickly is the sixth floor and the that part of the exhibition, which is always really tempting to use the word historical because it's sort of the easiest. But Barry was very adamant from an early stage of using the word contextual. So in a sense, I'm wondering how you see that as a sort of contextual foundation upon which your projects speak. Richard is, of course, on the sixth floor as well, so that might be an interesting connection for you. But what are these connections, or how do you see this as a contextual sort of platform for your houses?
Okay, there are a number of things that we've learned during this process, and has become even more clear with the exhibition, and that is the relationship between transportation and habitation in prefabrication. One of the most important human prefabricated projects is the International Space Station, and this is incredibly significant. And the thing that it does, and I believe the chances in prefabrication from our perspective, are that we must not just build by prefabrication what exists. We must go on and find new ways to live. And the challenge of the International Space Station, the microarchitecture, micro projects, are that we find ways of living that are more enriched spatially, because of the need. Prefabrication brings us the need to produce quality in the compact. And I think that this is an area which we mustn't think of prefabrication just of repeating the space standards of the past. It cannot happen in the new perspectives we're looking at. The two crises we face today are financial and energy and ecology. And we have to, as architects, now face those head on. And that's happened in, you know, a very short time in the end part of my career. But we are turning, we're having to turn very, very fast. And I think there's going to be, if there's another exhibition on prefabrication, it should be addressing those issues in a very, very powerful way.
Well, I think that it raises a question also, I think, in retrospect. And we did have lots of discussions at the beginning about this so-called historical or contextualizing show. Many have said, and this is one of the sub-themes of the exhibition on the sixth floor, many have said that we've been through a paradigm shift. You seem to suggest that there are others on the horizon. So you could ask the question, if there has been a paradigm shift, why should we bother to look retrospectively at 150 years of prefabrication that predate that paradigm shift? That was actually one of my provocations in the exhibition, in juxtaposing film footage of the Ford Motor Company of 1919 with the production of the Model T, which stands in as the kind of total symbol of the mass standardization, supposedly surpassed paradigm. Confronting that with the BMW factory in Leipzig, one of these places of high European design culture, that stands in for the idea of mass customization. And much of the discussion in recent years has been on the reason to return to any new horizons of fabricated architectures, off-site fabricated architectures, is because this paradigm shift from mass standardization to mass customization puts us in a whole new ballgame. So if we were to accept that, I think you would have to say that my enterprise on the sixth floor was completely fruitless, because that is documenting something that's supposed to have been left behind in the dust by the new rule. Nonetheless, one of the great things about doing an exhibition with density is that you can visit it yourself and discover things that you weren't thinking about when you put it together. And over again, your projects made me look at the historical material on the sixth floor very, very differently. And there were times, just because you're looking at me, James, there were times when I thought, as I stood between Buckminster Fuller and Conrad Voxman, that there were the origins of Kieran Timberlake, an obsession with how you could take a simple number of parts and fit them together with these joints. And I went to visit you in Philadelphia, and I thought, oh, my God, it's Voxman all over again, an obsession with the joint. And yet on the other side of that part of the sixth floor is, and I suppose this applies to you as well, Richard, there is Buckminster Fuller saying, we need to weigh our buildings. Mm-hmm. The lighter the building, the more it makes sense in terms of delivery. It's the history of heavyweight concrete prefabrication that is the dominant history of the late 20th century flew in the face of that. So Buckminster Fuller certainly looks relevant again on the other side of this paradigm shift. And at the same time, he said that the next challenge is to figure out how to integrate all of the systems, HVAC, electricity, plumbing as well, into the delivery of structure so that the prefabricated building would not need to be retrofitted on site. And some of you seem to think that that's the next horizon as well, but this is Buckminster Fuller speaking in 1930. So I guess I have the stage. I felt slightly vindicated that this history was not quite as surpassed as one might have thought, and that in many ways your research projects reactivated that history in ways that again made it open for discussion.
It's the reason you look at the machine when you're investigating the organic. I mean, this history, this 20th century of the Taylorist, Fordist language of putting things together has shifted. We are actually able to this measurement we're talking about is an organic measurement. The things that Richard are referring to and the things that we're measuring, we're not just measuring stuff. We're not just reproducing the same stuff over again. We're actually measuring the implicit and the explicit in doing these projects. And what's interesting about that is that actually puts architecture in an uncomfortable position, because architects, we're all, from Bucky Fuller to everyone probably here at this table, we're all very comfortable about figuring out the mechanisms and the tectonics of how things go together, but we may not be as comfortable about the social implications, the measuring of the energy use of the building 10 years from now, not just in the lead mechanisms of putting it down right now. So we're actually opening up a Pandora's box of what we call responsibility, in order of not just making stuff, but actually financing it, figuring it out, socializing it, and bringing these other implicit conditions to what's normally an explicit world in architecture.
Yeah, I think those other earlier propositions that are up in the show, tackle things from a very sort of simplistic, position, which is how can we take something, that and a system and a process that manufactures something, and also do something that's highly repetitious or apparently is highly repetitious, like dwelling or house, and make it available to the masses. And I think it missed a whole layer of some of the things that, Douglas is talking about in terms of the holistic view of what goes in the stuff of architecture, the ethically and environmentally responsible side of things. The simplistic nature of that is the repetition. And I think where we're at now is obviously what the show touches on and then is demonstrated out in the lot is the opportunities of mass customization. How do we get there, though? The tools have changed. I mean, from our perspective, and we only briefly, some of us touched on that in our presentations, and what's not readily accessible, I think, to some of the lay people out here is the fact that our three-dimensional programs, our four-dimensional programs, our five-dimensional programs that take into consideration not only space but cost and time that is represented in your house and all of the houses here and in the manufacturing of many, really enables us to do things quite differently than they were, you know, by Bucky Fuller and by, you know, some of the other architects that were exploring this very early on.
I think we have a good sense from James, what you're saying, and also Douglas, from what you're saying about how this exhibition might be, say, altering or shaping the discourse on prefabrication, at least within American architectural practice. But I'd be interested to think beyond our borders. And Oscar, ask you how this may be shaping a discourse in Europe or Austria specifically. Perhaps, Richard, you'd like to comment as well. But how has this been received in Austria or Europe? If you'd like to speak for both.
Yeah, I think we had a quite good press in Austria, Germany, Switzerland, but because they know us for quite a while. So we're doing this now for 12 years, so whenever we do something new, it gets recognized, at least Europe-wide. So I think the same question what these people always have in mind, and I can understand them, will it be an ex-prototype or will it be a working system? Are we able to bring this to a mass product, as we always talk about in the beginning? Yeah? We did, I don't know, 5 or 6 things we did. And whenever we had the presentation and we've been to Milano, we have been in Sweden, wherever, we always felt when we presented it that the concept is good, that we have a good price, and actually we thought that we'd like to sell it in a bigger scale. So, and I think in the end that's my only goal why I'm doing this. I mean, I like to see people living in there. I like to see people have an advantage out of this, what we're doing, because otherwise it's just something in the brain which is not bringing anything to anybody. So for me, and that's what we are trying at the moment to get this system on the market, I think for us there are 2 possibilities. And we sold already 2 or 3 systems and we lost a lot of money. So this time we have 2 possibilities. On the one hand, if we find, let's say, a contractor who is in, yeah, and we do it the slow way, let's say we build small structures and they pay, I mean, there would be quite easy because if we build them a structure, they pay us, but if they pay the architects, they also pay the system. So then you could check out whether the system is good enough, with all the details, with all the things you need before you start. And then you could start really slowly, but that would be, let's say, Vorarlberg, Austria, Swiss. Yeah. The other thing I'm trying, and that would be much more interesting for me, for us, if you get a big player, let's say a name, IKEA, for instance. They have a house, I know, but somebody like that could be very interesting if they really take our goal serious, that we don't want to sell for any price, that we want to do quality, sell for a good price, and give something to the people. Yeah? But that's probably difficult to get somebody like that involved because it's 2 totally different attitudes coming on each other. So.
That's been precisely one of the criticisms of the show from a couple of voices, and most strongly from someone we had here early on in the think tanks that led up to this exhibition, Colin Davies, who's written a book on the prefabricated house, the thesis of which is that prefabrication is alive and well. It's called manufactured housing, and it captures somewhere near in this country upwards to between 25% and 33% of new single-family dwellings produced in any given year. This is a stance he's been taking for a number of years. And last week he reviewed the exhibition in the Architectural Review and said, well, it's just another demonstration of the snobism of MoMA. There are plenty of manufactured houses out there, and not a one of them is to be seen in the exhibition. MoMA is simply perpetuating this cleavage that you just alluded to between the manufactured housing industry and architectural culture, and in the end, the exhibition has not done nothing.
You're just an elitist organization
to bridge this gap. Yeah. So, not asking you to show any allegiance to this elitist organization or myself, but I wonder how you, as practitioners who were invited into this elitist operation, would respond to that critique.
I think what Colin misses, you know, frankly, from that point of view is the fact that the point that Richard made earlier, and I think several others have made along the way, which is how do we get to that level of precision of the object, but of the affordability, you know, to the masses? And I think, you know, some of the things that Larry has been exploring, you know, with his students at MIT, I think, you know, about that sort of ethical responsibility of architects to help get, you know, well and high design elements, but at, you know, affordable, you know, prices, I think is really the holy grail here that we all in some ways in shape and form, you know, try to strive for. And that, I think, it doesn't exist in the current manufactured housing that Colin speaks to. It gets to, yes, it's affordable. But unfortunately, it misses one of the reasons why we as architects exist and one of the reasons why I don't think we'll ever get to the point where ultimately we can argue this in perpetuity about, you know, the masses becoming the designer is because I think there's a point at which, you know, there is a nexus of that quality and that and that object that still has to be, part of what we do. I don't know what you know, Larry. I don't know how you feel about that. I mean, thinking about that, you know, your particular house, you know, in the context of what you were trying to achieve. But you know, 109,000 different designs. I mean, that would take, you know, a tremendous amount of energy and effort, you know, to pull off at high quality without your system, you can't do that.
Yeah, you can't. So. But the architect does what most architects have been doing for a long time, developing the system. The thing that the pre-manufactured industry does not offer is the liberation of the liberation from the architect or liberation from the factory. It's still we still have to have a huge capital investment into the factory. A huge investment into the design system, and then at the end, a huge investment into the contractor. That's still there. And the question is, how do we get rid of at least one of those elements? If we get rid of one of them, we can make it more affordable, and we can get the user more involved in the process. If we look at what the web has done for communication, that has to happen for manufactured housing. The web has dramatically changed the way that we produce and deliver documentation and information and materials. At the end of the day, the information that's used or sent to the contractor is documentation and information. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there has to be some relationship between the computer and how we deliver our homes.
One thing that struck me in the research leading up to this exhibition was not only the predominance of the car metaphor, so I already cited how the car could take us from the mass standardization to the mass customization notion, although I do think it's interesting in a business model, mass customization is used as a way of adding price to, you know, a mass customized Nike shoe costs more than the one that you buy off the shelf. A mass customized house is supposed to undercut, you know, other houses on the market, but that's a different discussion. Nonetheless, I went hoping that Japan was obviously going to be the place where I was going to discover what Colin Davies tells us is out there. A lively and a vibrant culture of a manufactured housing where equally rivaling the numbers in this country but centered in some very, very powerful firms. And the one I chose to visit in Japan was the house fabrication factory of Toyota because obviously I wanted to go to a car company that was also producing houses. And Toyota changes its models every year. In this country, we're jealous of Toyota as, you know, Detroit may or may not survive the next round of government intervention. And one goes to the edge of Nagoya to see the Toyota factory, and this company is producing the least common denominator image of a house mm-hmm. that could have been produced 50 years ago,
right.
but the assembly line is identical mm-hmm. in its logic mm-hmm. to the car production assembly line, with sub-assemblies and the like, except the sub-assembly line is introducing the tatami room that's going to join the kitchen that looks like it's 1950s America into this absolutely caught in the notion that the market is traditional and let's not shake it up. And I asked if they had any notions of changing this in the near future, and they gave me the blueprints for the House of the Future, which looks like a House of the Future of about 1965 that they're going to introduce on the market with a certain number of ecological advantages in about 3 years' time. Hmm. So I even wonder, for those of you who play with the car analogy seems to have kind of left us behind in the dust in the culture of the fabrication of the house, which doesn't seem to me as liberating as a scenario as we might like to have.
Yeah, but the car, I have to jump in on that one. The mass-produced objects are that the cost is controlled or amortized over the number of products that are produced by that system. So you take a car, it may cost $2 million to set up a system to produce a car. That cost is subdivided amongst 500,000 cars, 100,000 cars. Houses are different. Every house has to be different. The site conditions are different. The delivery systems are different. The manufacturers are different. Where you get supplies are different. There's just too many. The building codes are different. It's a big problem. Everything is different. So it's very difficult to standardize a house production the way that you would standardize a car production. Very, very hard.
Well, if I could jump in on that, it seems like, to me anyway, that there actually isn't that much variation in cars. If you consider the variation in our five projects on the lot, you wouldn't see that, you know, in a car. It seems like every year there's a new set of cars, I go through them and see which one I'd, you know, like to buy, and I invariably come up with, you know, the same, you know, same answers. There's nothing right there that's that different from the year before. So, you know, I think that the expectation or the range that we're interested in researching, if you will, are the sort of developing the public discourse about the private space or the domestic space. That discussion for us, I think, is just about a much larger range that than is available in a standard production or a manufacturing sense you know, that we know. And that's why I think that there's so much investigation in the around the table in the production of houses. It seems like we're all in some ways inventing the factory as much as we're sort of inventing the domestic space.
Well, and I think in some ways the factory is, I mean, the same way the Taylor and Ford aren't the factories anymore, I don't think the factories, I actually find the factory paradigm wrong for this, the future of this production. I think it's actually much, much smaller scale. It's much, much more intimate. It's much more about setting up not methods of using the same shape over and over again. It's actually the methods of setting up parametrics that put the considerations of, in our case, program, environment, and structure into different sets of negotiations that are always built the same way. So the same way, like in the Andy Warhol portrait, you always know you're getting bright colors, black or silver ink, and your image on it. I'm speaking from the Burst, but also I think there are other people out there who are doing things that are, you know what you're getting when you go in, but what you're getting is responsive to the questions you ask. And I think that's what the change is. I don't think the change is, I think it's an uphill battle to remake the factory, and I think the computer has already shown us that we can participate at the factory scale of thinking at our desktop. And that we're able to do much, much more in smaller scale than we. So I think, I think in some ways like Oscar's talking about looking for the patron or the business model to come in to make these things work. I actually think that's actually a responsibility or one of those things we've opened in the Pandora's box of the possibilities and responsibilities. Actually, we have to know how to sell it. We have to know how to market it. We have to either team up with Nike or replicate Nike in our own way. And I think that's something that architects haven't always done, and maybe that's the new call isn't to figure stuff out, is actually to understand the art world, the marketing world, and the financial worlds that these things live in.
But I think the thing that MoMA experienced in doing five houses on the lot is there's a wide range of both time and quality that happens in the sort of paradigms that we've laid out in the lot. And I think the conundrum here is that all the individual, all the individualization of the house as necessary, which I fully subscribe to at one level. The question is, does that have to be through our particular hand, and that intention to realization? Right now we only control in that sort of design process and that drawing process, but that realization aspect involves a messy vitality of contractors and assemblers and fabricators and suppliers, and it involves time, and it involves environmental conditions, and particularly when you're on site with some of this stuff, the assembly conditions that get widely varied, as we only experienced in a very, very short season this summer, over a course of a couple of weeks. But if you extend that over 12 months or 14 months or 15 months, as some people out here might have experienced, you get all kinds of messes, in that particular thing. So I guess the problem that I foresee in this is that we don't necessarily, we, the architect here, don't necessarily control all of the things that we would like to control, the control freaks that we are, and that we need to find a way, we're all struggling to find a way to broaden that process so that we have more control in that process. But the actors I kind of wish Siami was up here, for instance, who bridged all of our gaps here, who enabled all of these to come together in a very, very short period of time, and where the kind of commonality amongst the factors here, at least as an oversight level, or from a direct hands-on level in terms of some of the assembly and positioning, because I think they have a unique position as a construction manager, as a constructor, in the messy vitality of putting these things together. And I just, the thing that worries me the most, I think, in the context of any of the propositions is, how do we get to that level of quality and precision that is, in the intention up in the fit, in the upper show upstairs, and the holy grail of many of us, but is out of the grasp of some of the realization, for many of us.
I think one of the
I'd like to open up to the audience
just for clarity. When I was a small boy, the kitchen was built by a guy who came in with a saw and, hacked it up and did that. And there's a tremendous parallel here that you get better quality from the Italian, German, Swiss, whatever, kitchen industry. And the Brits, maybe. I think it was even a British one. And because you buy the kitchen unit because you like it. And because it gives you better quality. And nobody's going to buy a prefabricated home until the quality is high and the cost is appropriate. Now, we're all driving towards that goal of a kitchen, the Bulltaub house or the BMW house. We're going there, but it's not easy. And we're way behind the transportation industry. And we're way behind the kitchen industry. But I think it's all signaling that direction. And it's just that we're, on the way. But
that's
helping
this
the way.
That's why this show is a celebration
Absolutely.
Of architects, because architects are almost always optimists. some of you, because you came out tonight when they're competing venues, I thought I
didn't want to close the evening without taking a few questions from the floor. There are some roving mics. Are there any questions either for the whole panel or even for a specific member of the panel?
Hello?
Hello.
Okay, I wanted to talk about every single one of your projects required armies of young people to put them together, and I wanted to talk about the kind of, have a discussion about the underlying necessity that in order to make what should be a state-of-the-art prefabricated manufactured dwelling, somehow it took a lot of people who were kind of underpaid but did it for the enthusiasm. And is that
I think that's a very wrong point about the projects in the show. And
I would
specifically say, in response to James' question about what are we doing as architects, and I think in some ways the Burst House we had 15 students or 15 contractors from Ryan Construction at any given time. And in some ways, what the responsibility of the architect is to do is to communicate it. And the students communicated and understood the process of it as a model, as a geometry, as a form, as a language, and the contractors understood how to do it safely, how to do it carefully, and how to do it correctly. And at the end of the show, the contractors came to the Ryan, the big 8-foot guy on Ryan who was running the thing, was, "You're so lucky to have those students." And in some ways, I was like, well, I knew more about the students than I knew about you, Vinny. And in some ways, that communication made that project happen in 10 weeks in a clear way. It's yes, it's craftsmanship, but it's in some ways the architect was the communicator, and the team of underpaid students who were all paid and fed and given a lot to drink, and the contractors who were given their salary communicated in a new way to make something happen in a very special event. So I think your position, I think it's an outside position and not the position of the way this project was done.
I think I was talking about it more from the level of craftsmanship, that the underlying level of almost old-fashioned craftsmanship that comes out in all these projects. And I think that what I see in all of them is that you have a lot of people doing digital prefabrication and then assembling it. You know, there's armies of people that need to assemble the stuff, and I'm just wondering if it could, what the next step would be, so that you could get it assembled.
I also want to jump in on that, because I think if you look at on the blog or any of the photos on the website, you'll see the same four people. You'll see a guy with a mustache, a guy with blonde hair, a really muscular guy, myself, and one or two other students every now and then coming in. But we had, on average, five people on my entire project from the day it started. There were many days where we only had two people working on the project, two people here on site. So, I'm sorry? Oh, and I could tell you, I definitely didn't have an army of. There was one day I think I had maybe six people.
What's wrong with an army? I mean, the Amish used an army every weekend to do a barn raising. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
But
that's a history of making things in communities.
But just to validate your point, if this were, and you're paying people by the hour, $35 an hour, yes, this would be extremely expensive.
I think her point might be a little different, and I don't think we ought to be defensive about it at all. If I can... I think your point is well taken in this regard, and I don't think we need to be defensive about it at all. And this is because it has a lot to do with schedule. I agree, none of them were underpaid, and they were all taken care of, but that isn't the point. The point really is here about schedule, I think, and about time. And in the context of trying to get our particular house together, clearly – the guys who built the model, and this was Douglas's point, I think, the guys who built the model in our shop, in our office, clearly knew some of the assembly points and the elements of, being able to pull this thing together in the amount of time. And so they were actually, supra four people, on the project in a way. Yes, there were some hands-on elements to what they were doing, but in working with the riggers and working with, some of the other assemblers that were on site, they were able to sit there and interpret the model and tell, you know, folks, you know, what needed to be done in order to get that joint right, so that it wasn't going to fall down, you know. And so they were translating the model. If we had had more time, I think we would have all had less people. And so, you know, in the context of syncing that time to the, you know, management model and the amount of labor on site, this was the kind of optimum for each of these particular houses. I mean, the most economical of all, I think, is Richard's house because it, you know, popped out of a container.
It probably took more people to design it because it was so innovative. It required incredible ergonomic precision and thought process. The students were all building models of the cube, and there were probably 100 models of cubes of different plan arrangements and combinations to try to find the best one. And the optimized thing you see in the Museum of Modern Art is the result of hundreds of people working on this thing, trying to find the optimized arrangement. It's not a simple thing to innovate. It's extremely time-consuming. And you mustn't devalue it because of that. It's extremely valuable that human beings do this, and we test our ideas so carefully. And I think it's a wonderful thing as well that we can do that, and we use universities to innovate. That's what they're for, to put something on the table and have a look at. And that project had very intense German design control and quality control, and Japanese, actually. We had Japanese students, too.
I think the myth is that architects somehow, you know, it's all up here in our heads, and it all gets down on paper through the sort of singular intelligence of one or maybe a couple of individuals. And I think Richard's absolutely right that it's the collective intelligence at this point in architecture that is really achieving some of the elements that we're all trying to produce. And that collective intelligence has to be not only within our shops or within our students and the people that we're bringing to these particular projects, but it's also in how we educate, you know, and work with people like Sammy, the crane operator, the Vinnies, you know, that help muscle these things together, because, you know, ultimately that has to get disseminated down to them in order to pull it together properly.
But another point is, if you ordered a micro-compact home today, it would be about five people putting it together, and you'd have it in 12 weeks. Okay, so it's really now it's the intensive work was the ergonomic design, just like a new BMW or a new dashboard. All of that takes hundreds of people's effort to get that tiny detail perfect in Germany. You know, they know it takes effort.
I think we should take one or two more questions. We're near the end of our time. I think someone has the mic, and then I'm afraid we'll only be able to have one more after that. Go ahead.
Okay. I'd like to ask Richard the question, because there's a bit of information that I seem to miss in this whole conversation. It has to do with, are these houses affordable? I don't know why, but Richard speaks of, or somebody commented, that your house is economically maybe the most economic. I figured from seeing your sketch with your hand up that it's about 6 square meters. Am I right? 6 or 7 square meters. It could you or any of you speak of how much it costs, those 6 square meters?
Well, I always say, when people ask me this, and they always ask me this when I talk about the micro home, they always say, what's the cost per square meter? And, you know, what's the area of the house? And the problem is we value homes by their size at the moment. And it's a very important thing that may happen. I think that because of the ecological issues that are happening to us, because of the economic things that are happening to us, we have to value land far more than we are. And that means thinking much more intensively about how we live with nature more constructively. And the purpose of the microhome is to start to evaluate beauty in the small scale, experience more nature, less material. if we could move towards that goal in our training of young people, rather than just throwing concrete at architecture, which is the sort of current thing, you know, the bigger it is, the better it is. I think we have to shift. There's a massive shift coming. And I think it's the microhome and the love that people have. Every day on the website, I get people writing how much they love the idea. Of course it's too expensive. Of course it's, you know, it's only produced the first time. We don't have BMW pumping them out. You know, we then or Toyota or the Czech car company or something. But it is far too expensive because it's so early in its embryonic stage of becoming something. The microhome is not the answer. But it's guiding a way forward, a different way forward from just reproducing the homes we have at the moment, which I think have to change. They have to get better quality, more energy efficient. They have to have a better relationship with nature so we can feel much better in our homes, but not necessarily bigger. So the issue of scale, I always say to people when they ask me, you know, the size of it. I said, tell me the size, the square feet in your car. Okay, and none of them can, you know, because you value your car in a different way to the way you value your home. We have to stop valuing the home by its size. They're not just garages for sofas.
Does anybody else want to answer the numbers question? You take one.
I would appreciate if one of you at least could give us a number, because Richard didn't give us a number.
No, I'd love to give you a number. Sadly, it's 34,000 euro. That's about $40,000. I think a bit more, maybe $45,000 for the microhome. And if you translate that to square feet, it's incredibly inefficient. So I'm not suggesting at all that we could sell a microhome in America. We probably couldn't. So, but the step is an important one, is what I'm saying. And it's a university project looking at compact living as a way forward for people living in cities, for young people moving to cities, all these things. I'm sorry, I'm hogging them.
Well, the unmet goal, just as to give a number, the unmet goal of our particular house was somewhere between, you know, $350 to $500 a square foot. And that was unmet because it's a prototype. And whenever you get into this particular situation where you're doing things for the first time, everything's 3 to 4 times more expensive. In the context of trying to take that money out, you know, part of it is in numbers, part of it is in systems, part of it is in, you know, rethinking some things that we saw as precious but aren't, once you do the first step, aren't so precious anymore. Car manufacturing has gone through, you know, 10 to 20 steps at this particular point, and that whole process of making an automobile or an object, an industrial object, has gone through a series of stair steps to bring it to production. And I think any of these houses, if they were going to go to production of whatever sort they've defined, I think would find economies of scale to reach, you know, their target square footage. But I would argue that I bet every one of these is, you know, somewhere between 2 and 4 times more expensive than they anticipated.
I'm sure. I don't know that it's been documented. I would have loved to have known, but nobody called me from reception to say there's a representative of a manufactured home company here at the exhibition to see it. It's disappointing to me that there's no evidence of an interest in it. But it is true that if you want to talk about the cost number, it is successful. This is Colin Davies' argument. I would hate to think that the problem stopped there.
Yeah.
And so I do think that as much as the cost issue is essential, to make it the single evaluating matrix for any of this research is ultimately I mean, I think that the jury will be out there. Well, those would never be satisfied if that final answer is not the successful one. Undercuts,
yeah,
you know, a stick-built house. On the other hand, BMW, is often used as the analogy, is one of the most expensive things you can get out there, and everyone desires it because of the quality of its manufacture. So there are many, many other matrices. I would love to see your system, Larry, applied on a kind of global scale to see what it might do, and would probably, in terms of global needs, and it might be heavily subsidized as it's delivered as a workable system across design that's not just for the kind of upward 2%. Is there one last question that's burning? There seems to be one right here.
I would like to say that I'm old enough to have seen the Japanese house in the garden, and I have a memory of a second house, and it's very much in the MoMA's tradition, and so you should not be apologetic in any way. Hmm. I expect this to go on over another, 100 years.
Well, thank you. That that can we take encourages us. We can take maybe one more over here.
That gentleman in the middle.
Model T was introduced in 1906. Sears catalog on Kenholm came out in 1906. Automotive industry is tinkering with aero cars. They're thinking about flying the cars. Honda's doing it. Toyota's doing it. In 100 years, prefab hasn't gone anywhere. And as I sit here, listen to you guys, I congratulate you for all your achievements and with great support from MoMA. But what I hear is, I think, Professor Suss, I think you're on a panel at Prefab Now conference about 2005, I believe it was in LA. It's the same level of dialogue that happens. It's about 10 years worth of investment in intellectual knowledge and capital investment, which architects never have sufficient resources to make. And it just keeps cycling, and there's no sustainability behind it. So my question to all of you is, when will the culture of architecture change from architect trying to control everything, skin to structure to infrastructure to distribution to land ownerships, and really come about designing what one of you has said, designing really based on a platform and standardization, where your ideas actually could be opened up to others to take on and create versioning process. Because none of us could do it by ourselves. And most successful commercialized prefab housing that's out there right now, whether it be Marmoraz in New York, California, Michelle Kaufman, whoever they are, as they become more and more successful, they start to concentrate on their product and they start closing off on this openness to allow their knowledge, allow their wisdom, allow their gains to be shared like a scientific platform, like a software platform. And I think we really need that. And until the culture of architecture changes, just like the culture of Washington needs to change, I think we're going to have the same dialogue every 5-10 years.
Yeah,
so
you've answered the question, which is that we need more research. Because research is about dissemination of information and publishing of systems. All of the science that goes on at MIT is published in papers, and other people can critique it, reuse it, and build off of it. In architecture, we don't have that. Probably I would say out of all the people here, the only person I really can say is that's published a lot of their research work is Kieran Timberlake. They put themselves out there for other people to build off of. But that's still not enough. We need research money the way that the other fields have had it. We need money to make mistakes, and
Are you yourself doing something to create
that? That's very difficult, and I'll tell you why. The main research that comes from science and engineering comes out of the government. The NSF pumps millions of dollars into science. It's very difficult for architects to get involved in the NSF or organizations that pump millions of dollars into research. And that's because there's not a body to build off of.
I think it's an extremely valid point. I think it's one that comes across in the historical exhibition. There's no mistake that 1948 to 1951 is the high point in research and prefabrication, because that was precisely the moment when governments on both sides of the Atlantic, fearful of a post-World War II recession and a bank collapse, pushed money into housing industry so that the armaments industry would not lead to a worldwide recession, i.e. return to the 30s depression, when all of these armaments factories closed down. And that is why everything from Lastron to Jean Prouvé, etc., are all related to the retooling of the World War II military economy into a brief moment of a very heavily subsidized but intensive. The biggest part of the bibliography for the exhibition also comes out of that period. So yeah, I think it's very, very valuable.
But they're published.
But it's also, in some ways, you're taking away the optimism of the show, in that the show puts, in some ways, the equivalent of the government support or the research or the dissemination of information is the 500,000 people that have come to the museum this last 4 months. And that's widened the lens, that's widened the awareness of what prefab is, how it's defined, how it's used, and the language of architecture in relationship to that fabrication technique. So I think in some ways that's one of the things that's been most, in some ways, the most rewarding about being involved in the show, is that that lens of architecture that we see in, you know, in America, it's always defined as, I don't know anything about architecture, but I know what I like.
No, but he
is actually opening it up. I'm not closing it down. I'm saying that this forum is a form of what he's asking.
Yeah.
I acknowledge the point from this perspective. I think if you look at this time in 10 years from now, I think it will be comparable in a different kind of way to the sector of time that Barry has just spoken of, where there was massive amounts of money and sort of technological knowledge, you know, being infused from above, as opposed to some of the knowledge that you hope for, which is represented by this table here in terms of a kind of open sourcing, you know, way of, you know, attacking a variety of different processes and a variety of different design to production methodologies. And I think the last 5 to 10 years of architects looking at offsite fabrication has actually advanced the model. It may not appear so in the objects, you know, that, you know, people critique, you know, and participate in, but there's great amount of advancement in that realm. And I would say that within the next 10 years, if this show had a retrospective in 10 years, you would see very, very different objects out on that site, and you would see them coming to play in a much more rapid resourcing way. The vast majority of the things that are commoditized at this particular point, yes, have done so because they've locked in their intellectual property and they've tried to protect it from an investment point of view. And that's, rightly or wrongly, you know, the nature of you know, the economic, you know, circumstances that we find ourselves in. But at the same time, that doesn't rule out the fact that there's been, you know, a great advancement. That's the piece of it I don't agree with.
I think that's the place that we have to stop, even though it's to cut off conversation that is heating up, I think, in interesting and productive ways. To me, this exhibition was and is a research project, and I'm enormously grateful to the people that are assembled here at the table for their ongoing participation in it. Most artists deliver a painting or a sculpture to the Museum of Modern Art, and then it's admired, and that's the end of the process. You people have not only designed something new, you've documented it, and you've come back for numerous debates, and you've participated in an enlarged public discourse about the fraction of the issues that are involved that we've been able to expose here. And I'm going to not only thank you, but I'm going to thank you in my typical way by asking you to do something, which is that it occurred to me this evening that we also need closure in the documentation. I'm going to invite all of you to, in the time that you like, provide a final closing statement to, we'll reopen the blog just one more time, and each of you can put a concluding statement since we have to cut short here now, and that way, because the blog is going to exist for as long as it's sustained by the mechanisms that keep it running as an archive of the last, let's say, year and a half between the time that we first contacted you and a month from now when the houses will be on ships and planes to other places. So thank you again for your interim interest in this, and thank you all for coming with your challenging questions, because it was our idea tonight to have not a celebration but a debate. So thank you very much.